That was Maria Tickle at Melbourne's Trade Block Cafe. You're listening to Blueprint for Living Highlights here on RN Summer. I'm Michael Williams. It may be Saturday morning, but that's the sound of Thursday afternoon, composed by one of the pioneers of electronic and ambient music. It's Brian Eno. It's 1985. It was released as a one-hour-long composition. Eno's been described as one of music's most innovative figures, marking a shift in the way we think and the way we talk about sound. Our next guest this morning also believes he can make us think differently, this time about typography, comparing the patterns and forms and the spaces in between of music and letter design. Stephen Banham is a typographer with Letterbox Studio in Melbourne. He's written a recent essay about the way music has been a soundtrack to his designing life and the parallels between those two worlds. So he's here to give us a musical demonstration of this theory. He's here in the studio. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Very well, Michael. And yourself?
I am very well. Let's start with Brian Eno, if we can. There's a bit of a story, isn't there, to the way Eno created this particular style of ambient music?
Yes, it's a fantastic story that he actually outlines in the liner notes for Discrete Music, which is one of his first albums. It really is about the accidental discovery of ambience, the fact that he was injured, he was laid up in bed, and a friend came over with the record, put the record on, but didn't realise that the amp was virtually silent. There was just a tiny amount of sound coming out. And because he couldn't get out of the bed to change it, he just sat there and he started to listen to this record in almost complete silence, and he began to think, this is kind of interesting, this idea of space and absence is really interesting.
Surely by definition, type isn't space and absence. It's got a job to do. It's having to kind of connect something and connect meaning. It can't be as recessive as a Brian Eno song.
That's very true in the sense that it does have to communicate content. There's no doubt about it. But type is, of course, composed of spaces within and without the form. So type designers in particular do tend to focus on the space inside and outside of a letter rather than the black stuff, rather than the ink on the page. So we are actually very comfortable with the idea of form and its companion, absence.
Before we get to that kind of part of your theory, for you, music plays a big part when you're doing design?
It certainly does. And just going back to your intro, I think what I'm really arguing about here is that it can be actually far more than just a soundtrack. A soundtrack infers a kind of passive consumption of music. What we're talking about here, I guess, is a kind of a structural parallel between typography and music. And there are two particular genres that I point out in this article, which is primarily ambience and the Jamaican dub plates of the 1970s.
Let's hear a sample of the second type of music, because I think that's where your argument gets really interesting.
No cliche, here come Jacob Miller.
Baby, I love you so.
So, okay, Jacob Miller, Baby, I Love You So. Talk to me about how this connects to type in your mind.
Yeah, well, it's quite typical of a dub in the sense that a dub like type makes no pretensions to creating a completely new form. All of type is based on the alphabet, of course, and even within that, when you're designing a typeface, all of the weights within that, of course, have to relate to a kind of stylistic master.
So correct me if I've got this wrong, sorry to interrupt, but a dub as a musical form tends to sample heavily from previous bits of music?
Well, in fact, what it actually is a direct interpretation or reinterpretation or variant of an existing track, and that's what makes Jamaican dub in particular quite interesting, because they were endlessly producing versions of the same track, and as a result they began to experiment with the idea of multi-channeling and so forth, and people like King Tubby and so on are very well known for that. So they actually began to abstract the music, even though of course it's all within a set set parameters, just like a typeface. So there are parallels.
I can see that. There's only so much room to move.
You're, exactly. Is there
anything new in typefaces under the sun, or is it endless reinterpretation?
I would say that it is actually endless reinterpretation, because if you don't refer to the alphabet in type design, then of course it becomes so codified and abstracted that no one really understands it. So it has to operate within a very tight set of parameters. Yeah.
There's a great line in your essay where you say, type is a difficult thing to explain to many people. It's obtuse, odd, and verging on the arcane for some. I mean, is that partly what you're trying to do here, is give a vocabulary that allows people to understand how someone creates a typeface?
That's precisely the purpose of the piece, because type is notoriously hard to describe and articulate its purpose and its manner. And music, of course, is one of those things that everybody knows of, everybody has very strong opinions of. So music metaphors are very common when people start talking about type. So in this particular article, I'm going one step further by indicating particular kind of case studies that have been important to me personally. Of course, I'm not saying that everybody's going to get into this kind of music, but it's just a personal perspective.
And as you say, from the ambient is one thing, but the dub is about rhythm, about repetition,
yes,
presumably, and it can be mirrored much more in the kind of actual visible outcome of the typeface design that you do.
That's right. It's certainly far more evident than, say, that Brian Eno piece, for example, particularly Thursday Afternoon, which is almost a non-present piece of music, which I guess goes back to the theories of Eric Satie and all these other early minimalist sort of composers, yeah.
So let's hear another track that you've chosen. This is Flash Gordon meets Luke Skywalker from the album Scientist and Jammy Strike Back. See, that sounds like classic Palatino to me. No, I'm being facetious, obviously. But, you know, the funny thing for me about dub, as someone who doesn't listen to it, is the differences between different dub tracks are often not immediately apparent to me.
Yes,
that's right. They belong to a kind of broader typeface family.
Well, sure. This perfectly picks up my point, is that many people who don't like this kind of music say, oh, God, it all sounds the same, in the same way that most people, when they're looking down their font menu, go, oh, my God, how am I going to decide these typefaces? They all look the same. And what that does is highlight the fine grain of this kind of visual language and, indeed, oral language when it comes to the music. So it's an incredibly nuanced, detailed kind of language. And that is really the essence of the point that I'm trying to make, is that they do both have that in common.
So having identified this relationship for you and your creative process when you're putting it together, does it run further? Do you hear a bit of music now and start to picture type, picture words? Are these two things inextricably linked for you now?
They are linked for me, just because of my personal experience of that music. And that was one of the reasons why I actually was interested in type, because I used to work on Waves magazine at 3PBS in the 80s, and it used to coincide with the reggae show. So I'm forever having to align the idea of hand-drawing headlines, for example, with the idea of listening to dub. It was a very early kind of influence on me personally. But as I said, I certainly don't expect this to be completely appropriate to everybody, but it's more the theory about these fine-grained languages.
Stephen Benham, thank you as ever for your time.
Thank you, Mark.